When I was in grade school, I remember participating in class projects where we made time capsules. We did this multiple times in multiple classes in multiple grades, little boxes filled with the hopes and dreams and expectations and frustrations that occupied our world back then and there, sealed up to be evaluated by our future selves. I don't know what happened to any of those time capsules. I never saw them. They were buried away. They never came back out. And quite frankly, I have no idea what I put in them. I don't remember. But I wonder if the things that interested me then and there, the things that seemed so important to me then and there, I wonder if they would have anything meaningful to say to me in the here and now. Would they have something to say to me today, based on where I was then? Our text today is a time capsule of sorts. It tells us of a people struggling with ethnic division. It tells us of a people struggling with justice issues. It tells us of a people struggling with a government that they don't agree with. Things we still struggle with today. And because of that, though this epistle was written by Paul for them then and there, it still has the power to speak to us here and now. And we're going to try to listen to what he has to say today. If you'll turn and meet me, we're going to be in Romans chapter 12 today. Romans chapter 12, as you recall, Paul had been invited to come to Rome in order to defend his gospel, which according to the Jews, removed the Old Testament. Paul wasn't able to come immediately, which was interpreted by some to mean that he couldn't defend his gospel. He was ashamed of it, so he was avoiding Rome. So, Paul pens this epistle to explain that he is not ashamed of his gospel, which is based on the Old Testament, and delivers man from the wrath of God by the gift of grace received by faith in Christ Jesus. Paul's condemnation of works-based righteousness was also a condemnation of national Israel. And Paul explained that this is because they didn't understand the righteousness of God. They sought to establish their own righteousness. They rejected Christ and thus rejected their function in the purpose plan of God to bless the world. They were to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, through whom the nations of the earth would be blessed. But they rejected it. But that hasn't hindered what God is doing, nor is it a plot twist in the story. Their disobedience was foretold from the beginning, and God is using it to give mercy to the Gentiles, and not to the Gentiles only, but to Israel as well. Now, pick up Paul's argument in chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, I urge y'all, brothers, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Paul has finished making the point in chapter 11, verse 32, that God has shut up all in disobedience in order that he may show mercy to all. You know, both Jew and Gentile are deserving of God's wrath. But both Jew and Gentile have been shown mercy. They are on equal footing before the cross. Now, having both become recipients then of the mercy of God, how should they then live? So what, Paul? How should they then live? Now, there's no longer any need to seek mercy from God through the sacrifice of bulls and goats. God didn't seem too impressed with that anyway. As he says in Hosea 6:6, I delight in chesed rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offering. God delights in chesed. He delights in sacrificial mercy. So what should we do? Paul says we don't offer sacrifices. We live sacrificially. We don't offer sacrifices. We live sacrificially. What does that mean? Well, think about the function of a sacrifice. You know, what is it? What does it accomplish? I think on a basic level, a sacrifice is something offered on behalf of another. You know, it might be to please a god, to appease a god, to persuade a god. You know, it doesn't matter. The point is, the thing that is offered is being expended for the benefit of another. The grain is being burnt up. The animal is dying. It doesn't benefit the dying animal. Doesn't do a thing for it. It benefits another. It benefits the one offering the sacrifice. Now, with all of this in mind, a living sacrifice would seem, in some ways at least, to be a contradiction in terms. What would it mean to be a living sacrifice? Well, I think it's what we've seen Paul talk about before. Back when we were in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he says, I die daily. It's the same thing that Jesus spoke of back in Luke chapter 9, when he says, if anybody desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Dying daily, taking up your cross daily, it means self-denial. Self-denial. That's not some kind of asceticism. It's not some sort of prohibition against self-indulgence. It's not when you're on a diet and you deny yourself a piece of cake after dinner. It's relational. It refers to how you interact with other people. You know, it's the laying down of your rights. It's the laying down of your desires for the benefit of another. Be it God, he's a person, or be it man. To the end that you're showing preference for another is what you're doing. You're preferencing God's desires or the desires of your neighbor over your own. You are loving God with all your heart, mind, and soul. You are loving your neighbor as yourself. And in so doing, then, you are fulfilling the law, which is exactly where Paul is going to go in this section, in chapter 13, verse 8. He's going to say, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, it's summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. It is the fullness of the law. It is the point of the law. It is the character within the law. So Paul says, live sacrificially, which, he says, is their, and it's rendered spiritual service of worship. This is Kenny's refrigerator verse, so since he's not here, we'll go ahead and correct it, and you guys can correct him. Actually, no, he actually is right on the money. He often points out that the term can be rendered reasonable worship. He's exactly right. It is their reasonable worship. Paul says, this is obvious. Connect the dots, okay? This is the same standard that we saw God direct towards Israel in the story. He delivers them out of Egypt, and then he gives them the law, and in the law, he's explaining how they are now to treat those around them. So Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 19. Show your love for the alien. Why, God? For y'all were aliens in the land of Egypt. Do for them like I do for y'all. Okay, this isn't hard. He's saying connect the dots. If you have received mercy, then you ought to be given mercy out. The standard's been set by God. The expectation is reciprocity to those around us. You know, to the degree that you have received mercy, you should be dispensing mercy. And let me tell you, you ain't going to outgive God. He loves to give mercy. A superabundance of mercy. He backs up the dump truck and just lets it all come out. He cannot wait to give mercy. So since that's what he loves to do, and that's what we have become the recipients of, that is what we give out. Mercy. Sacrificial mercy. And sacrificial living, then, Paul will say, will require the believers at Rome to adjust the way that they think. Adjust your thinking. Verse 2, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Do not think like the world. You need to think like a Christian. We know how the world thinks. You know what the world says to do. Do what's right in your eyes. The world says, you want, you need, you desire, you deserve. How does the Christian think? Well, he doesn't think more highly of himself than he ought to, verse 3. For through the grace given me, I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. But to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. For just as we have many members in one body, and all the members don't have the same function, so we, who are many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. Since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, each of us is to exercise them accordingly. If prophecy, according to the proportion of his faith. If service, in his serving. Or he who teaches, in his teaching. He who exhorts, in his exhortation. He who gives, with liberality. He who leads, with diligence. He who shows mercy, with cheerfulness. You know, there's no longer any need to seek mercy from God through sacrifice, and there's no longer any need to social distance. Says Jew, Gentile, doesn't matter. Okay? Paul says, someone who has received mercy better not be putting themselves up on a pedestal. They ought to have a sound judgment. They better gauge themselves against the measure of faith. We're thinking of a standard measure, a standard measurement, a yardstick of faith. Everyone has received the yardstick of faith. We all have it. You know, if you've ever been to the fair, you go up to a ride and you see the sign that says, you got to be this tall to ride. Well, God's given everybody this standard measure of faith that says, you got to be this righteous to judge. Okay, you had to come into this thing through mercy. Remember that. It's a reminder, they've all received mercy. You guys have been judging one another. The Jew's judging the Gentile because the Jew thinks since he has the law and knows it, that makes him special, even though he doesn't follow it. That was chapter 2. The Gentile is judging the Jew, we're going to find out, because he knows that it's about faith, that the righteousness comes by faith. And he says, well, you're over here struggling trying to keep this law. You know, you're just not, you're weak in faith. It's chapter 14. So they're over here judging one another. He says, stop it. Jew, Gentile, it doesn't matter. We're all in this thing together, and we all need each other. We need one another. God has set up the game to be that way. We are one body, each individual members of one another. So treat your brother with the same preference that you might treat yourself, since he is actually a member of your body. There's no second-class citizens in the kingdom. There's no second-class citizens in the church. Everybody is essential. If anything has been revealed to us by coronavirus, I hope that that's one of the lessons that we are taking away from it, is how essential, how needed every member of our body is. Because we feel it, don't we? Come in here and, of course, because of the need, the worry of the pandemic and social distancing, we've taken precautions and we feel the distance. We feel when our community is not together. Because everyone is important. Everyone is needed. And God has specially gifted each person to build each other up. We feel it. Paul says, let love, verse 9, be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what's good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. It's all right. If you Jews and Gentiles want to find some way to compete with one another, how about you try to outdo each other in honoring each other? How about that? How about you see who can go to greater lengths to build one another up, to meet one another in their need? How about you make that your ambition? Because we're in this together. But notice, there is a common problem. Because they are one body, because they've been brought into this thing through the same Christ who showed them the same mercy of God, now they also will suffer from the same tribulation. That is, as long as they're aligning themselves with Paul, they're all going to be getting hit. Notice it. Verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. Bless. And do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. And weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind towards one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as depends on y'all, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you'll heap burning coals on his head. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. To be in the body together means to suffer together. Paul says, bless those who persecute you. Who are the ones persecuting them? Who are the ones that might be considered as, verse 20, their enemy? Who are the enemies from Paul's perspective in this book? Chapter 11, verse 28. From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for y'all's sake. Who are they? They who? They, Israel. National Israel. The ones that are putting them out of the synagogues. The ones that are chasing Paul everywhere he goes and putting a whooping on him because he's teaching, from their perspective, the removal of the Old Testament. He's teaching that you don't have to come through Israel to have a relationship with God. He's teaching that you don't have to be circumcised to be right with God. So bless those who persecute you. You know, Paul's a bit of an expert on this subject. He's been on both sides of the aisle. You know, he persecuted the faith as an enforcer of Israel. And he's received persecution for the faith as an apostle for Christ. So now he's telling the believers in Rome, look, persecution's coming. Don't curse Israel when they start hitting you. Bless and don't curse. Why should they bless national Israel and not curse? What would it mean to bless someone, or to curse them for that matter? What are you doing when you do that? The language of blessing and curse, now these are expressions we give out that deal with the future, our future desires, our future hope for that individual, what we want to see happen to that individual. That's what we do when we bless people and when we curse them. We are expressing our desire for them. So why not curse Israel when they persecute them? Because they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. That's Romans 11:28 as well. They are enemies for y'all's sake, but from the standpoint of God's choice, they're beloved for the sake of the fathers. Because they are going to be grafted back into the promises. Because God has not abandoned or forsaken Israel. Because they will become your brothers and fellow members of the body. They're coming back. They just don't know it yet. a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles have come in. And then all Israel will be saved. Their restoration is inextricably tied to our future hope. So the sooner they return, the better. So to curse them is to say, you know, I want God's wrath to come down on the nation. You don't want that. You want God's blessing to come down on the nation, because that means life from the dead. That means the story's heading towards the kingdom. That means the king is returning. That means everything's coming back to the way it should be. We bless them. We want good for Israel. Their good is our good. So bless them. Don't curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. On the one hand, that sounds like a platitude. But there's a little bit more to it. In fact, there's more to this whole section, the context behind this section, the thing that Paul's been talking about this whole book. Who might have reason to rejoice in this book? Who are the ones rejoicing? Listen to this. This is chapter 15, verse 8. I say that Christ has become a servant to the circumcision on behalf of the truth of God to confirm the promises given to the fathers and for the Gentiles to glorify God for his mercy. As it is written, therefore I will give praise to you among the Gentiles and I will sing your name. And again he says, rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people. And again, praise the Lord, all you Gentiles, and let all the peoples praise him. That rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people, that's the end of Deuteronomy 32, that passage that he keeps quoting. That's the end. The Gentiles are rejoicing. Why are the Gentiles rejoicing? Because through Israel's disobedience, the Gentiles have received mercy. So they have suddenly become participants in this thing. They have received mercy, peace with God. So he's saying, Jews, rejoice with the Gentiles. Share their joy. Join them in celebrating their reconciliation with God. Because they're part of the body. But he also says, weep with those who weep. Anybody have a reason to weep in this book? Chapter 9, verse 2. I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart. For I wish that I myself were accursed from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites. Why is Paul grieving? Because national Israel's unbelief for the present time has severed them from the promises. It has made them enemies of the gospel. His people have become the opponents. So of course the Jewish believers are grieved. That's their problem. What about Israel? So Gentiles, weep with the Jews. Share in their grief. Join them in mourning for the rebellion of their nation. Rejoice with the Gentiles. You Gentiles weep with the Jews. Verse 16. Be of the same mind toward one another. Don't be haughty. Associate with the lowly. Don't be wise in your own estimation. Don't be wise in your own eyes. Who's in danger of becoming wise in their own estimation? We're still. This is all in the same context. Jew, Gentile, Israel. Israel's hitting them because Israel has rebelled. Bless, don't curse, rejoice, weep. Who's in danger of becoming wise in their own estimation of what's taking place? Listen to this. This is chapter 11. We just read it last week, verse 25. For I don't want y'all, brothers, to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and so all Israel will be saved. See, the Gentiles, the Old Testament story is a mystery to us. We don't know the Old Testament. We don't know the Scriptures. We didn't come into this world with that as our tradition. Or at least Paul's audience didn't. These are pagans. They're out there worshiping rocks and bedazzled stumps and Athena and Zeus, etc. They're in Rome. And he's saying, all right, this might be a mystery. You might not understand what's going on, how y'all have come in and started participating in the promises, and now Israel's God has become your God, and the nation over here are now the bad guys in the story. But don't you for a second get puffed up and think it's because you earned it, or God chose you over them. He got tired of their mess. He picked somebody better. Don't get puffed up. Don't be wise in your own estimation. Don't think that this has been so easy for you and they just can't get on board. Why? The Gentiles are obviously puffed up because they realize that they got into this thing because of Israel's rebellion. What they don't realize, and what we still don't realize today, is that that's all been part of the plan. God isn't done with Israel. He's going to bring them back. Historically, you know, we have completely failed to understand this. After Titus, in 70 AD, the Roman commander Titus comes and he destroys Jerusalem. Destroys the temple. Paul writes this in the late 60s. This letter here. He doesn't live to see the destruction of the temple. But in AD 70, Titus comes and wipes them out in Jerusalem. And that's not enough. They're still around until AD 135 with this thing called the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. The Jews rise up against Rome. Bad move, Jews. Rome crushes them. Disperses them amongst the nations. Renames Judea Palestine after the Philistines. So not only do they crush the Jews because they're tired of their mess and rebellion, they scatter them, and then they erase their national, the land of their inheritance. We're going to just erase you from the history books. This is the Philistines now. So when the church then historically, which had become increasingly Gentile with the spreading of the gospel, the Gentiles are receiving it, the church had become increasingly Gentile, and now we got to figure out what to do with this Jewish book that talks about, it seemed to make promises to a people that aren't a people anymore. What do we do with it? Has God failed? So we came up, we tried to, we were like Abraham. You know how God makes a promise to Abraham? Abraham says, Lord, I don't see how you're going to do it. I don't see how, you know, Sarah is barren. Maybe I can find a way to help you fulfill your promises. Here's Hagar over there. We do the same thing historically. We said, well, Lord, I don't see how you're going to fulfill your promises to Israel, but here we are. So we have this thing we call now replacement theology. We replace Israel. And there's different flavors of this, but the earliest one is called punitive supersessionism, punitive replacement. God has gotten tired of Israel's mess. They rejected his Christ, so God punished them by kicking them out. They're no longer his people anymore. Now we're his people. We have replaced them. And that's exactly what Paul is saying. You Gentiles better not do that. But we still do it today. A large portion of the church today does not see a future for Israel. But it's not because the scriptures don't teach it. It's because we didn't see it in the newspapers. It wasn't until Israel became the player back on the world scene that we started saying, maybe. I mean, it was actually just slightly before that, in all honesty. After the Reformation, when we're starting to read this Bible, more people have it in their hands and we're starting to take it in a normal reading. People saw it, and then lo and behold, here comes Israel back on the world scene. So now people do see it as a possibility. But that had nothing to do with God's promises. It had everything to do with our newspaper and our lack of belief that he could fulfill what he said he would fulfill. So you got people, you know, it's still a mystery to a large portion of the church today that thinks that they are Israel. We're not Israel. We're part of this community, though. The body. We participate in some of these promises that was promised to the forefathers. So we shouldn't be wise. We don't want to do that. Verse 17, he's going to say, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Y'all are suffering persecution. Y'all are suffering tribulation. Okay, endure. Don't try to even the scales. You don't have the ability to even the scales. When Israel is hitting you, it's not your job, it's not your position to make it right. The problem with persecution isn't merely that pain and injustice is inflicted. The problem with persecution is that it also has the tendency to facilitate a self-righteousness within the individual who is experiencing it. It can make one feel justified in their mistreatment of others. Okay, well, this is how y'all have treated us, so we're justified when we come and do the same thing to y'all. Which is why historically, so often the oppressed who lead a successful revolt inevitably become the new oppressors. You've just gone from one regime to the other. But it's that same self-rightness. I'm going to hit you back. We've been experiencing quite a bit of unrest in our country lately. I mean, unrest that is tied to those who feel unjustly treated, that they've been oppressed. It needs to change. So we're going to right the scales of history ourselves. So you have organizations that come who have mottos like, no justice, no peace. And we riot. Paul says, don't do that. By the way, Nero is in power. Nero is the governing system over here that's taking care of things. That's the government. He's saying, let them handle it. Never pay back evil for evil. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. Respect the legal processes that handle this. They're there to take care of it, which is why he's about to start talking about the governing authority. You don't do that. That's not your place, believers. Let Rome handle it. Is essentially what he's saying. Let Nero take care of it. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. Respect the law of the land. As for y'all, be peacemakers. As far as it you can, as far as it depends on y'all, be at peace. Do everything you can to be at peace. Never take your own revenge. Leave room for the wrath. For which is written, that vengeance is mine, I will repay. We've heard that before. Guess where it comes from? Deuteronomy 32. But listen to the whole quote. This is the whole quote. Vengeance is mine, and retribution. In due time their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. Who are they? God's people, his rebellious son, Israel. So this is in part of Moses' song. He's explaining what's going to happen. He says, I'm going to take care of it though. They're high on the hog now because of all the things I've given them. And now they're worshiping the nations because they think it's their gods that did this. It wasn't their gods, it was me. I did this. And the day is coming when I'm going to repay them for their treachery. That's what he's saying. So we're still talking about, never take revenge on, don't take out your revenge on Israel. Don't try to even the scales. Don't try to hit back. God is aware of all this. Okay? They think that you're under the wrath because they're persecuting you. That's the charge. Paul, God's taking his wrath out on you. How do we know? Because you're getting beat up. Well, if you guys would stop beating me, then I wouldn't be getting beat up, would I? He says God sees it. He knows what his child is doing. He's not an absent father. Vengeance is his. He will repay. He will make it right. He's going to deal with the problem. So Paul's saying, don't curse Israel when they persecute you for the gospel. Bless them. Don't hit them back. Don't get revenge for their mistreatment. The Lord sees it all. And by the way, in just a couple years, that's when Titus shows up. Destroys Jerusalem. A few more years, Bar Kokhba. He spanked his child pretty good. Verse 20. So, treat Israel well. And it says, you feed him when he's hungry. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For you'll heap burning coals on his head. There's all kinds of questions about what this is talking about. The general consensus that I think fits in the context is we're trying to make them remorseful. We want to make them return. We want to make them join us. So in doing these good, if your enemy is treating you poorly, and rather than returning blow for blow, you return for their curse, you give them a blessing, they're going to have a hard time being your enemies. I think he's talking about making them, facilitating guilt, bringing about their remorse, bringing them a return. Don't be overcome with evil. Don't join Israel in their wicked ways. But through your good deeds, make them want to join you. Don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. We're talking about Israel. Don't be overcome by this persecution game, but instead, overcome it. Make them jealous. Make them return. That's our whole ministry. Chapter 13. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God. And those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do y'all want to have no fear of authority? Do what's good, and you'll have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to y'all for your good. If you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God and an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. What time period are we living in here? We're looking at the biblical plot. We're looking at the unfolding of God's plan. We're looking at Israel's present rejection and being set aside. What are the times that we're living in? The times of the Gentiles. It is the Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, now Rome. That's the times that we're living in. So don't get all zealous and try to go over there with Israel and oppose Rome as though God hasn't set them there for their discipline. They are a minister of God in the present time, in the times of the Gentiles. That's where we're living in. By opposing them, you are setting yourself against God's purpose, plan, and history. I think we still struggle with these kind of things today. We talked, this was months ago when we were in 1 Corinthians, about our Chinese brothers. When the government is cracking down on them, it is cracking down on their assembling together, actually, in peaceful protests. They were meeting still, and the pastor had been taken into prison, and he was saying, "But we are not. We accept the consequences. See, we're not rebelling against the government. There's an issue that the government has said, if you do this, this is how we'll respond, and we feel compelled that we have to continue to do this. So we do it, but we also accept the punishment." We're not complaining about it. This is just the way it is. We recognize that God has set the Chinese government here. Which China is much worse than America, but let me tell you, Nero at Rome is much worse than the current Chinese government. And that's who he's telling them. He says, you shouldn't. They're there in order to serve God's purposes by restraining evil. That's the whole purpose why God gave us human government. It is to restrain evil. Restrain evil. Now, what's the evil behavior that Paul keeps bringing up in verse 3 and verse 4? You know, rulers aren't a cause of fear for good behavior, but evil. It's a minister of God, verse 4, for your good. But if you do evil, be afraid. It's an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. What is the evil? What evil practice will result in the government's acting as God's avenger? Chapter 12, verse 17, never pay back evil for evil. Verse 19, never take your own revenge, but leave room for wrath. Verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Saying the government is there to take care of this, but if you are trying to take justice in your own hands, if you are trying to get your revenge, if you're trying to pay back evil for evil, watch out. Because in stepping in to serve, to do what this minister was put in place to do, you're usurping their authority. You've made yourself an opponent of God. So be careful, because that minister is going to do what God has put him there to do. And he's going to punish you. So if you're out there doing vigilante justice, watch out. It's not your place. God knows about the wrongs in the world. He's going to right the wrongs. You don't worry about that. You serve in the position he's put you in. And right now we're living in the times of the Gentiles. That's it. We don't have perfect governments because people are flawed. But we do have a God who's capable of righting all wrongs at the end of the day, in the place that we're looking. Our place is to endure. Right now, I'm sure y'all are very aware, I was very surprised this week to see that Ruth Bader Ginsburg just passed away. Of course, right on the eve of an election cycle, as if things could get any more polarized. And some people are already out there calling, saying, if this happens or if that happens, we're burning the place down. We reject what you do. We're going to riot against the government. There's all these hostile feelings on one side of the aisle or the other. If this person is elected, if that person is elected, I'm not going to accept it. Paul says, don't do that. That's not your place. The government is a minister for your good. It's not perfect. It won't be perfect till Jesus comes. But it does serve its function. We fortunately have probably the most privileged position in all of history to actually be participants in our governing system. We have somewhat of a voice in some way set up so that we can participate as believers and say, you know, we don't have perfect options. This is something just quite transparently I've struggled with for years. A believer is not compelled to vote. You don't got to vote. It's not, you know, choose the best of two evils. You don't got to vote. You know, you got Jesus. And either side, I hate to tell you, neither side is going to bring in righteousness into the land. They don't have the ability to do that. So it's not the end of the world if one side gets elected or the other side gets elected, and God's capable of directing the hearts of the people. But here's my struggle. I also lived in a privileged place in history where I have the ability to say, I think this side or I think that side restrains evil better at this point in history, this particular candidate or that particular candidate. And so many Christians take that position. That's a perfectly fine position to take. And I think my own personal struggle has been there aren't any perfect people. There's only Jesus, and I don't have a Jesus to vote for. But within the imperfection, God also works. He raises up nations to judge nations, doesn't he? He uses Nebuchadnezzar to judge. He uses Assyria to judge. Wicked people, that was Habakkuk's problem. He said, Lord, judge the people in the land. I'm judging them, Habakkuk. Don't worry, I'm judging them with Babylon. But they're wickeder than we are. He says, I know, I'll judge them too. I'm able to do that. God is restraining evil and promoting righteousness, even within what seems to us to be a whole deck of bad choices. And I think that that's our dilemma, is how to do that as believers. And I think that you can be an honest believer and take any three of those options. Not voting. Voting for one side or voting for the other side. You can do all three with a good conscience. That's where we're at. The point, though, at the end of the day, is just because we have the ability to participate in our election cycles, we also don't have the right to revolt against them. Not the believer. You know, it might not be the option we wanted, but we got to accept it. We got to accept it. At the end of the day, owe nothing to anyone but love one another, he says. We render to these governments what's due to them. He says, that's why we're paying them taxes, because they're God's servant. They are performing this function for you. They are providing security for you. They are there to restrain evil for you. What you need to do then is to make sure you're doing your part as God's servant, his minister, which means loving your brother, loving the body. That's where we come in. That's what we're responsible for. We all know. I mean, you can't love God if you can't love your brother. How can I say I love God who I can't see when my brother's over here and I hate him? So this is Paul's message. We're moving in through Romans with the people that is struggling now. They realize that Israel will now become their enemies if they align themselves with Paul and his gospel. And they'll be persecuted if they try to do what's right. And the same thing is true for us today. You try to do what's right, you're going to get hit. Guaranteed, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. The question is, what do we do with that persecution? How do we endure? How can we endure? How can we deal with the injustices in our world that don't seem to have any chance of being righted in our lifetime? Well, we have resurrection power. We have a future and a hope. We know where the story is headed. And that gives us the power then, in the meantime, in a tumultuous election cycle even, with a divided country and a coronavirus, to stand firm and to offer love and to bless those who mistreat us or who curse us or who say nasty things about us because they don't interpret our vote or whatever with charity. We love. We suffer, we endure, because we know what's coming.